This is the Piece of Advice podcast coming to you from the University of Oxford. My name is Tiril Høyran, and I'm an MPhil student in International Relations at Oxford. Today, I'm sitting down with Marie-Joëlle Sahar to talk about achieving and sustaining peace. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And a little bit about Marie-Joëlle before we start. She has extensive experience as an academic on civil war and conflict resolution. She's a professor in political science at the University of Montreal and the director of Research Network on Peace Operations. She also has experience as a practitioner working as a senior expert in the Office of the Special Envoy of the United Nations for Syria and served as a senior expert on power sharing and process design on the standby team of mediation experts at the UN Department of Political Affairs. And recently, she wrote the article Sustaining Peace One Day at a Time with Erin McCandless. And in your research, you look at the best way to achieve and sustain peace. I wanted to ask you, what are the key takeaways in academic literature for a practitioner looking to achieve and sustain peace?
That is a very, very large question. And I think that I'm not going to give due credit to the richness of the academic literature. But I think that we can actually answer the question by separating the achievement of peace from its sustainability. So when it comes to achieving peace, I think that the literature has really focused on two things. The first, how to convince parties to lay down their weapons. And the second, how to manage spoilers. However, in doing so, the literature has also highlighted that both of these things, successful negotiations and the management of spoilers, require support from the international community. Now, in terms of sustaining peace, I would argue that there are at least three main takeaways. The first, which comes from the literature on power sharing, is that one needs to give the parties to the conflict incentives to stick with the peace deals that they sign. The second, which comes from the whole literature on state building, is that you need a state to provide both security and to assure citizens that they will not be threatened by third parties. In a book that I edited a while ago in 2008 with my colleague Steve Seidman, who is currently at Carleton University, we talked about it as achieving a balance between deterrence and assurance. So the state needs to be able to deter those who want to use weapons against either the entire nation or part of it. It also needs to be able to assure various groups within that it does not intend to either use itself or allow others to use weapons against them. And I think that the third big takeaway is that whatever practitioners do, local ownership is key for the long term. So the way I think about this is you need international support to move from war to peace. And even as you move to a negative kind of peace, you need to be able to keep the parties interested in supporting that peace. You need to be able to lay down the foundations for a state. And you cannot do that simply from top down. You absolutely need to marry top-down approaches with bottom-up approaches. So that would be my key takeaways from the very vast literature on achieving and sustaining peace.
Thank you so much. That is a really good take on a very large question. And I wanted to then dive into one of your recent articles, where you present the idea of building resilient social contracts as the best way to achieve and sustain peace. And I wanted to ask you, what is resilient social contract? And could you talk a little bit about how this translates into practical implications, particularly from bottom up and ownership of the piece?
Oh, absolutely. So first, I think it's important to give credit where credit is due. The project on forging resilient social contracts, in the context of which this piece was co-written, is actually the brainchild of my co-author, Erin McCandless, who put together a group of practitioners and academics to look at the issue of the sustainability of peace and brought us to think about the way in which social contracting could help. Now, what is social contracting and what is a resilient social contract? I would actually say that a resilient social contract is very simply, for those who might not be specialists, the glue that keeps the state and society together. It is the various links between states and citizens made of both duties and responsibilities on each side that, in our argument, allows them to weather crises, allows them to actually face obstacles that will emerge in the context of peace implementation, and to prevent these obstacles from basically reverting the situation into a situation of armed conflict.
So what are some of the implications of this?
Well, there are a number of implications for practitioners. When it comes to peace settlements, it means that practitioners have to think about who sits at the table. They have to find ways of preventing the settlements from being captured by narrow interests. Secondly, it also means that practitioners have to think about what kind of state they are helping to rebuild. The state must be able to develop public policies and deliver services to citizens, because that contributes to the social contracting and to the legitimacy of the state in the eyes of citizens. But it must absolutely avoid delivering policies, services, and benefits to only one part of the society, something which we know has been one of the root causes of civil wars. And then, more importantly, practitioners must not focus only on top-down approaches. And that is often quite difficult, particularly when you are thinking about states and international organizations, which tend to be much more comfortable dealing with their likes, i.e. with other states, governments, officials, rather than dealing with what they consider to be a bit of a chaotic societal groups, communities, what have you. But it is absolutely important and essential to be able to deal with the society in all of its complexity if social cohesion is going to be supported, if it's going to be improved, and if it's going to become one of the pillars of the resilience of a post-war society.
Yes, that is very, very, very interesting. And you talked a lot about inclusion in some of the implications of a resilient social contract. And what does quality inclusion mean for peace? And how can it be implemented? And particularly, what are some of the key aspects a practitioner should keep in mind when working with inclusion? You touched a little bit upon it regarding top-down, but what does quality inclusion actually mean?
In my understanding, quality inclusion means two things. First of all, that inclusion must be meaningful, that we need to go beyond the symbolic inclusion of a number of people that we bring in and stir into the pot, something that has often happened when we thought about the inclusion of women, for example. Let's bring a couple women to the table, but we don't really think what that means, who they represent, what their priorities are, and how to make them effective once we put them in a situation where they are a minority among, for example, a majority of armed actors. So inclusion needs to be meaningful. It cannot be simply symbolic. It also needs to be sustained. And what I mean by sustained are two things. Inclusion has to happen not just in the peace settlement, but also in the building of the state and in the design of efforts to promote and to support social cohesion. So it has to be sustained across all levels that the international community, and I use this term between brackets, is going to be involved in. It has to be sustained over time as well. And it should not be something that we remember at critical junctures, but otherwise dismiss because it complicates the way in which to design programs and to deliver them. So meaningfulness and sustainability are key to quality inclusion.
So how do you decide who should be present at the peace negotiation? Particularly, how do you deal with the trade-off between a lot of voices and efficiency in a peace negotiation?
This is an excellent question, which allows me to also talk about another great collaboration that I've had with Sarah Helmuller from the Graduate Institute in Geneva. We both are wrapping up a project looking exactly at this question, because we think that the debate about efficiency versus inclusion is a false dilemma. It is a false dilemma because inclusion does not necessarily mean being at the table. There are different ways in which one can be included in a broad process of conflict resolution. If we take, for example, the South African case, South Africa managed to get people to chime in through a big process of consultation in which there were fora, there was an internet platform, there was the possibility of bringing expertise to the people who were at the table and negotiating with one another. That is the kind of inclusion that we advocate, not necessarily increasing the size of the table in a given process. Now, the other thing as well is that how to decide who is to be included depends very much on the context of a given society. And although we tend to think nowadays of inclusion primarily in terms of women and youth, there have been some excellent analyses of late, for example, highlighting the importance in some instances of bringing the business sector along. So for me, deciding who needs to be included requires an analysis of who has been excluded and also of whose competencies, whose support are absolutely needed to give peace a fighting chance. And I use this term with a bit of a wink because it's odd to talk about a fighting chance for a peace process. But in many ways, peace processes have to really go through a number of hurdles before they can lead to anything sustainable. And so it is a bit of a tough ride between the moment of signing and the moment when one can declare that peace has been really re-established, in which case I think it is important to also make sure that the analysis is updated regularly, because people who might be very important at the table might not be the same people that you want to be involved and important at different points in post-conflict societies.
And do you have beyond, now you touched a little bit upon South Africa, do you have any other examples of quality inclusion that you've seen really, really worked for building resilient social contracts?
I have to say that unfortunately, in my own experience and in the processes that I have had the opportunity to support, this one was one of the most difficult challenges that we had to overcome, because the tendency is very deeply ingrained to, first of all, continue to keep peace negotiations under wrap, so not to really share developments in the process with the broader community that is absolutely interested in the way in which a process is being negotiated. Second, I think that it is very challenging because international organizations and states, when they mediate, and in spite of a commitment to inclusion, which is more normative than practical in many instances, have difficulty imagining ways of including efficiently, particularly various groups within society, because they see society as this complex set of actors that they're not familiar with, and where they're afraid, as you suggested, that their inclusion might actually affect the efficiency of the process. And the third thing is that part of the challenge is also because we think of inclusion currently in terms of what I would describe as a snapshot, including at the moment of the negotiations. Whereas in my mind and in our mind with Erin in the article that was the basis for this whole discussion, inclusion is an ongoing process. It's not something that begins and ends at a specific time. It is an attitude towards the way in which elites and societies need to interact with one another, and also an attitude towards the way in which the international community should approach these processes of a negotiation and peace building.
Thank you so, so much. I wanted to pick your brain for one last question regarding the different ways quality inclusion can take place. You mentioned, for example, internet or forums. Are there any other mechanisms that have been discussed in the academic literature that you think practitioners, that could be interesting for practitioners to know of?
There are a lot of mechanisms that are discussed in relation to various case studies. And I honestly do not think that it is the mechanisms per se that are important, because they will vary and the usefulness of given mechanisms will not be the same across cases and contexts. In my mind, when I think about the implications for practitioners, I think of the implications in terms of three big, I would say, principles. The first is the need to know the context. I talked about it earlier, the importance of analysis. You need to understand who was excluded, why they were excluded, and to understand dynamics of inclusion and exclusion in a given context, to be able to think specifically about who needs to be included, how to broaden the space, and what mechanisms might be useful in a given space. My second principle would be inclusion cannot be something that is reserved, for example, for the work that one does at the bottom or simply at the top. It must be a transversal dimension of a practitioner's work. It's not just when talking to elites or talking to community groups. It is also in actively engaging the elites and the community groups in every aspect of the practitioner's support for a peace process. And I would actually maybe say here that, unfortunately, even when practitioners talk to a society, we tend to talk to people who are like us, i.e. there is a bias to talking to people who are more educated and therefore can speak our language, because we often do not speak the languages of the societies in which we work, and that is a problem. We also tend to talk to people who have been trained in our institutions or who think like us and therefore can understand the frameworks with which practitioners come, the templates, the programming, the requirements for all kinds of like project documentation. And that means that we tend to exclude those people whose perspectives might be very important, but who do not necessarily have the same set of skills that makes the conversation easier. My third principle, and I think that is the one where we can do a lot quickly if we adopt it at the start of a process, is to demand accountability on that score. Demand accountability for inclusion and exclusion from oneself and from one's partners. And oftentimes, accountability is not demanded, particularly of elites, because we are afraid that if the elites of a post-conflict country disagree with us, we are going to either be PNG'd, so excluded, sent out, removed from the process, or that we are going to cause the elites difficulties that might endanger the peace process. And so what happens more often than not is that we settle for compromises on issues that tend to be extremely important, as we argue, Erin and I, for the viability of the process. So in answer to your question, although I don't think that it is important to think about specific mechanisms in the abstract, I do think that the implementation of these three principles might actually get us further in order to bring about quality inclusion. But I would probably like to end my thinking on this by highlighting that quality inclusion is not the solution. It is an important tool that societies have that will allow them to weather the crises that will face them. But sometimes the crises are much bigger than any resilience, any social contract can bear. And sometimes societies will be overwhelmed by these crises. However, the point here is not necessarily finding the perfect solution that works all the time. It is, in my mind, to think about what gives societies, again, using that expression, a fighting chance on the road to peace.
Absolutely fantastic. And you've given a lot of advice today, but I wanted to end with asking, what is your piece of advice, if you had to give one in about 30 seconds?
Well, my piece of advice would be, if it doesn't work, ask yourself why, adjust your strategies, and try again. Because failure is not an option. Victory and imposition are morally indefensible. All that is left that is ethically acceptable is for societies to find a negotiated way to actually move ahead. And they and us have a responsibility to accompany one another on that very difficult path.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Marie-Joëlle.
Thank you, Tyrell.
It's been an absolute pleasure to get to talk to you today at our podcast, Piece of Advice, coming from the University of Oxford with the UN Academic Impact Hub.